We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 12 today. And just by way of a little bit of introduction, let's think about what's happening in this particular occasion. First of all, one of the unusual things about this particular passage is this scribe is a good one. You know, we demonize the scribes and the Pharisees, and a lot of it comes from what we see in the Gospels. They aren't necessarily the nicest people to Jesus. They tend to resist what he's doing. These are the leaders of the Jewish people. But here's a scribe who kind of has it together. He has a pretty good understanding. Because when he asked Jesus about what the greatest commandments are, he affirms to Jesus that, yeah, that's really true. He says, to obey is better than all burnt offerings. And Jesus commends him for that. He even tells him, you're not far from the kingdom of God. And the scribe here apparently is drawing on some things that we know about from the Old Testament, not the least of which is a passage that Jesus himself will quote from Hosea chapter 6 and verse 6, and he says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Focusing on the things that are really important. You can go through all the religious rituals of bringing sacrifice all you want, but if you're not obeying God, it doesn't really mean anything. And the passage that Wayne read this morning as well, 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 22, to obey is better than sacrifice. Offering sacrifices to God is only as good as the heart of the person who brings the sacrifices. Obedience still counts for something. And that's a very essential message, even to the message of the gospel. What I'd like to think about today is the far-reaching consequences of obeying, in particular, the first commandment and the second commandments, as are mentioned here. Jesus is asked about what are the most important ones. And he says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Jesus is quoting not from the Ten Commandments, although it's very clear in the beginning of the Ten that to love God first is everything. But he's quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 4. He's also quoting from Leviticus chapter 19, which is rather interesting, only because we tend to avoid Leviticus because it's about all the sacrifices. But in Leviticus is the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And the reason I wanted to think about that today, I think most of us here know what those commandments entail. What I think our community, our society is neglecting is what are the consequences of not obeying those commandments. There are some serious things down the road that happens, and they don't always happen right away, but they begin to happen slowly but surely when we take for granted a number of other things. Or when we reject the command to love God first, because a lot of things follow in the wake of loving God first, not the least of which is all the other commandments that come and are attached to it. Don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie. All those other things, they all come in the wake of love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. Those things, those are the essence, that is the foundation of a lot of other things. And when we neglect that particular command, at some point, those things begin to fall by the wayside. I heard our culture described quite a few years ago, actually, a writer, I guess, in the either the 50s or 60s, Elton Trueblood was his name. He described our generation as a cut flower generation. And this was a while ago that he actually mentioned this. It's rather interesting. What happens when you cut flowers? Well, they stay nice for a while, don't they? They stay pretty for a while. You can even add some floral preservative to them for a while. But you know what? Eventually, they are going to die. And they are going to die because they have been cut from the roots. They have been cut off from the roots of the thing that really gives them their nourishment. And we are like that generation. When we are cut off from the roots of what give us all the things that are essential to us, we begin slowly but surely, even if you try to add a little preservative in there at some point, we begin slowly but surely to die. And one of them actually is kind of an odd one that I think our culture doesn't realize. Well, first of all, our culture doesn't realize that we're kind of dying because we've cut ourselves off from loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. If in fact we ever had it fully, we seem to, at least in my years growing up, at least our institutions said something about, you know, those are the right things. Even if we didn't always do them well, we kind of knew that was the way to live. But now we're not even admitting that those things are important. Well, one of the odd ones is the whole question of mercy and compassion. Now, think about what you see today. Political activism has a lot to do with we need to help people. We need to raise money for people. We need to go out and collect money and collect food. And those are really, really good things. I'm not denigrating in any way, shape, or form any of those things. But you even see companies today that not only do they want to sell you a product, but they want to sell you on the fact that they are giving some of the proceeds to such and such a cause. Take a look at some of the things you read, yogurts and chocolates and various things. You know, we're donating X percentage to these causes. And quite frankly, it's part of the sales pitch. You know, you're not just buying a product, you're buying their services to whatever, thing that they think is really important. I think that's a pretty good thing. But I would suggest to you that at some point, because they have cut themselves off from what really drives that compassion, and that is, quite frankly, the love of God, that eventually that's going to die out as well. Maybe it won't be so popular in another generation. Maybe another generation will come up and say, why should we do that? What reason can you give us why we ought to be compassionate? Other than it's now very, sort of fashionable in a way to do that. It's not fashionable because God says to do it. It's fashionable because that's what a lot of people are doing. And it seems to be the right thing to do. In the first century, when Christianity first started, there was a kind of context in which that happened. And quite frankly, that was mercy. In many of the pagan philosophers, was a pathology rather than a virtue as it is in Christianity. The philosophers, and I'm getting my information here in part from a study that was done by a guy named E.A. Judge and passed on in The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark, but he said a number of things about the early philosophers. They said that mercy was a defect of character to be avoided by rational men. And he went on to say that humans, and quote, they must curb the impulse, unquote, because it is not governed by reason and is contrary to justice. He continued, and I quote, pity was a defect of character unworthy of the wise and excusable only in those who have not yet grown up. It was an impulsive response based on ignorance. Plato had removed the problem of beggars from his ideal state by dumping them over its borders. This is who the philosophers were. This was primarily the thing that informed much of culture in the first century when Christianity arrived on the scene. This was the moral climate in which Christianity grew up. Christianity, we are told, has one of the primary virtues of mercy. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 7 simply says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. This was kind of a new concept of Christianity. God loves humanity, and humanity must therefore love their neighbors as themselves. We read about this also in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16. Interesting that John, the apostle of love, makes this very clear, perhaps. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. People know what we believe by what we do, not just by what we say, not just by giving a lot of rhetoric. Now, behavior demands were not necessarily new among the philosophers. the pagan philosophers had demands that, you know, they felt like were an important part of satisfying some sort of a just and orderly society. But what was new was God's love for humanity. The pagan gods didn't love humanity. You could manipulate them by offering sacrifices and doing things to get them to do your bidding for them, but they didn't really love humanity. In fact, many of them were exactly like us. You know, they committed adultery, they killed their children. I mean, they did all kinds of bizarre things. These were the pagan gods. These were the inspiration for society. Along comes Christianity and says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." And to make it even farther, in Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 48, Jesus does something that's really kind of outrageous. He extends the love that humanity is supposed to have for one another, even beyond the bounds of family. You know, everybody can talk about, well, it's important for us to love our family. And I look at that and I go, wait, so? Everybody knows that. Everybody affirms that. What does Jesus do? He says, love your enemies. Love even those who are not a part of your family. Your love is supposed to extend even beyond what the normal understanding of love is supposed to be, by loving those whom maybe you don't even know. Okay? It goes beyond family and friends. Jesus says, you know, if you greet only those in the marketplace who are your friends, even the tax collectors and sinners do that. Our love is supposed to extend beyond that. That's what Christianity brought to the world. And that's what Christianity brings when it brings love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Because that comes directly from that first commandment. And if we don't have the first commandment, the second one doesn't really make sense. The second is second, not because it's of less importance, but it comes from the first, love your neighbor as yourself. You love your neighbor as yourself because God loves humanity. That was brand new in Christianity. That brought something to the world that we did not have before. And that's why it was able basically to turn the world upside down. Rodney Stark has a thesis about that I thought kind of important. He says, central doctrines of Christianity prompted and sustained attractive, liberating, and effective social relations and organizations. Basically, what Christianity brought to the world sustained society in a way that nothing else did. It made a difference in the world. And this is one of them right here, that mercy was an essential ingredient to Christianity. Obeying the first commandment changed the outlook of the people in the first century. Let's talk also about perhaps Christianity's view of women, abortions, marriage, response to epidemics. I know I'm kind of throwing a whole bunch of things at you all at once, but I want to take them one by one because I think those things also stem directly from that first commandment, and we are missing them. Our society is missing that. Those things are going to go by, some of them are going by the wayside now because they're missing the first commandment. They refuse to obey God. They refuse even to believe in God in some ways. Number one, women and abortions. Let me read to you a letter from a man that we have from the first century, from a man named Hilarion to his wife. His wife, Alice, A-L-I-S, by the way, was pregnant, and he was away, I guess on business. And listen closely to the letter he writes. Know that I am still in Alexandria, and do not worry if they all come back and I remain in Alexandria. I ask and beg you to take good care of our baby son. He's not been born yet. As soon as I receive payment, I shall send it to you. If you are delivered of a child before I come home, if it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, discard it. You have sent me word, don't forget me. How can I forget you? I beg you not to worry. Now, other than the apparent shows of affection from this guy for his wife, how did he feel about having a baby daughter? She's worthless. Get rid of her. You know, there's still female infanticide going on today in the world. in China, where they have a one-child policy, guess what a lot of people would prefer to have? They want to have sons. So they will perhaps get an abortion if they think it's a girl, or if they know it's a girl. Selective abortion was not only frowned upon, but all abortion was frowned upon and condemned by the early church. Why? Because they valued life. Just because a baby was a girl didn't mean she wasn't important. Does Christianity elevate women in society? It not only elevates them, it sanctifies them. It says there's something sacred about them simply because they're alive. They are a life that God has given us. Christians condemned all abortion and female infanticide, which was quite common in the first century. A favorable view of women in the first century by Christians was also seen in a number of other things. Number one, they condemned divorce. They condemned incest. They condemned adultery. And they condemned polygamy. Christians also renounced the double standard that demanded chastity in women but allowed sexual license in men. How many of you are familiar with the name Helen Gurley Brown? She's the woman who founded Cosmopolitan magazine. Now, she kind of turned this whole idea on its head in a little different way. She looked around at society and said, well, men are sort of expected to be sexually active. And, you know, we sort of give them a pass. Instead of saying to men, well, you should be sexually self-controlled, she said, well, women, then you get to be sexually active and liberated. Cosmopolitan magazine represents the actual opposite of what Christianity is trying to do. She said, okay, women, you can go be as sexual as you want and have as many partners as you want. And let's promote that instead of promoting the self-control that men ought to have. Christianity said, look, everybody is expected to control their sexual appetites. Men and women included. Now you tell me which of those particular values has made a better difference in society. Looking at what happened in the 60s and how the 60s sexual revolution has sexualized society to the point now where, you know, it's like, well, you know, anything goes. We don't even think much about it anymore. We kind of expect everybody to do that. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, we see why loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength makes a difference for marriage. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, the writer says, let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and the adulterer. In Ephesians chapter 5, 22 through 33, the same thing is said. In fact, in that particular passage in Ephesians 5, it says, men, you treat your wives just like they're the church. You behave as if you are the Christ. You sacrifice yourself for your wife if you have to. That's the essence of marriage. And the covenant of marriage is such that when two become one flesh, that's an essential ingredient, not only to society, but to Christianity. Maybe I should say it the other way. It's essential to Christianity. It's also essential to society. That's what builds society. When those units of families behave in a way that is consistent with loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Today, marriage is under assault, not just by the homosexual movement. You've heard me talk about that quite a few times, but it's also under assault in the heterosexual community, who see it sort of as an unnecessary encumbrance to self-fulfillment. I don't know what you think about Adele, and this is not just to condemn Adele. But the latest thing that I see happening, certainly in Hollywood and all the elite types, is have babies and then maybe get married. You know? And it's like, where do we come off reversing the order on that? You know what the percentage of unmarried births are in this country now? It's about 40%. 40% of the children born in this country are born out of wedlock. That is a staggering figure. Now, I remember a number of years ago when I went and I talked to the man who was the vice principal down at the middle school. And he told me there were close to 50% of the kids that were coming to that school. This is not to do with just being born out of wedlock, but they're living with a single parent. Almost 50%. Now, what do you think the fallout of that is going to be? And this is not in any way, shape, or form to denigrate and to shame those of you who've gone through some of that or trying to raise your children as a single parent. But I'm sorry, it's just not the best way. It's not God's way to do things. And the fallout for that is going to be just enormous. And I probably don't even have time. I was going to give you some information on this one study that was done. What's missing from our middle class debate? What's missing from our middle class debate is essentially the essence of marriage, that people need to get married and then have children and stay together. Amen. And they looked at a study of two women who went to college together, one who got married and stayed together and one who didn't. Suffice it to say simply that the one who didn't stay married, her children are poorer, they don't do as well in school, and their prospects for success are a lot less. Love God with your whole heart, mind, and soul means get married and stay married and raise your children in that environment. That's one of the keys to loving God first. Loving God demands that we love the institution that He created for our benefit. And that is the institution of marriage. And let me just kind of finally throw this last thing at you. I actually talked about this once before a number of months ago. But the early churches, by the way, this whole thing about marriage, that made a difference in the early centuries. You know, even some of the critics of Christianity looked at Christianity and said, you know, their women are more chaste than our women are. You know, and the men were expected to stay with their wives. Now look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians about that. Even if we don't fully understand what he's talking about, he's talking about a relationship that needs to stay steady, needs to stay intact. But their response to epidemics really kind of goes back to this whole idea of mercy and how it was that in their response to some of these epidemics really demonstrated something different than what the pagan philosophers and what the moral climate of the day really demonstrated to everybody. Okay, there was a number of epidemics in history. One of them is mentioned that happens in Athens in 431 BC, and the historian Thucydides actually describes the epidemic in Athens. He said many died with no one to look after them, and he said a number of other things. Quote, men were indifferent to every rule of religion and law, and no fear of gods or law of man had a restraining influence. In other words, when these epidemics hit, people just panicked. They ran, they hid. They didn't care about anybody else but themselves. Well, there was another epidemic in Alexandria in 251 AD, after Christianity had been around a while. Similar pagan responses in Alexandria were similar to what happened in Thucydides' day in Athens in 431. They ran. They were afraid. Even the doctors panicked because they didn't know what was causing it. And so nobody helped anybody, except for the Christians, which is really, really unique and unusual. Here is what one writer told and described about what happened among the churches, among the Christians during that particular epidemic. Most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves and thinking only of one another. Heedless to danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ, and with them departed this life serenely happy. In other words, they took care of them, and they got sick too, and died because they were taking care of them. For they were infected by others with a disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their deaths to themselves and died in their stead. Some got the illness, the ones they were nursing lived, and they didn't. The best of our brothers lost their lives in this manner, a number of presbyters, deacons, and laymen winning high commendation so that death in this form, the result of great piety and strong faith, seems in every way the equal of martyrdom. Why were the Christians different? How did that affect society? people looked at them and they said, wow, they're doing something we're not doing. Why are they doing that? They're doing it because they valued mercy. They're doing it because they knew God's command to love their neighbors as themselves and to love God first. Christian teachings of compassion, self-sacrifice, and care for people provided, in stark terms, a prescription for action. As opposed to the pagans who say, well, we're leaving because we don't know what's going on. We want to save ourselves. Christianity stressed love and charity, love of neighbor, as central duties of faith. And these are sustained in everyday behavior. But they are also sustained when you take that first commandment as the very essence of your faith. Because a lot of things, as I mentioned earlier, sort of come along in the wake of love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. These are demands of Christianity. We cut ourselves off from that, we will eventually, and I believe are eventually, losing those things. Such crises and outlooks helped elevate Christianity and eventually slowly topple paganism. Oddly enough, one of the things that Rodney Stark goes into, the fact that probably more Christians actually survived the epidemics than pagans did because people helped nurse them back, even if they didn't know what the cause was. So in a very ironic twist, Christianity grew just because more of them survived than more of the pagans survived during some of these epidemics, at least. The two greatest commandments are the cornerstone of our faith. Jesus makes them the cornerstone of our faith. And Jesus expects that we will obey those commandments to the best of our ability and our knowledge. Now, we know that God's mercy is also great, that when we don't always obey them, God's mercy, I don't even want to say fills in the gap, but God's mercy is what really gives us anything to go on. It's also the foundation of who we are and what we do. And it's another reason why we love God with our whole heart, mind, and strength, because God has loved us first. No other faith can say that. Other faiths usually are simply demanding of, you know, behavior, or they tell you, well, here's the way to truth. Our faith says God so loved the world that he gave his only son to die for us. God will judge those who do otherwise. And it's interesting to me because God's judgment doesn't always come immediately, you know, with big lightning bolts. It happens as we begin slowly but surely to deny God or to deny what he wants. And the process of leaving him, God just says, well, he kind of says what Paul says in Romans chapter 1. Verse 24, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And in verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind. You see, when people begin to choose against God, God says, okay, I have warned you, and God will continue to warn, but at some point, God just lets them go. And their behavior ends up receiving sort of the due penalty of them rejecting God. When you continue to reject marriage as an important thing, you just kind of begin to look around now and you begin to see the fallout of people not really being concerned about marriage, the devastation that it wreaks on the children in those marriages is just one of the major things that you really cannot deny. The economics of staying together. I mean, if you reduce it simply to economics, people who stay together are better off economically and their children are better off economically. You can't have somebody else come in and do it for you. That's like putting a little preservative into the cut flowers. It doesn't work. What works is doing what God commands. Without the two commandments, society will collapse under the weight of its own unrighteousness. These things, love God first, love your neighbor second, have created a community of love and hope. And I guess, you know, if nothing else, I would like us to take some encouragement from that, that we should not take those things for granted, for what they have really done, maybe because we're really close to it, maybe we forget just what they've done and how much they make a difference. You know, it's funny today because as I talk to kids or you know, young adults and Sometimes I find myself saying to them, you know, you have an advantage. Your parents stayed together. And I'm thinking, as soon as I say it, I go, that's not just an advantage. It is an advantage, but it's like, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. But in fact, it is an advantage. It should be the norm. And I would just encourage us to say, you know, don't take that kind of thing for granted. Because it really does make a difference that we've obeyed God with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and need to continue to do so. Let them continue to mold your life. Love God, love your neighbor. It's really that simple. And have the courage to do so, to love God first in spite of what everybody else does. Again, my words today are not simply to denigrate those who have gone through those struggles. You know, we've gone through it. My family went through that when I was younger, and you know, we have to make a difference though. We have to go from where we have to move from where we are. And we have the mercy of God as well. When we've made those mistakes, we simply have to recognize them and try to move forward. That's the blessing of Christianity as well. And that's something that provides for society something it can't get elsewhere. Forgiveness, redemption, salvation. Those things make a society so much different than the society of a world without those things. So let's just continue in them. Floyd, let's stand and sing. Thank you.